1 Corinthians 7:1 through 7:7, the 18th talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on July 14, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We come today to a famously difficult section of 1 Corinthians. It had such an influence in various ways on the history of the church, debated as to what it's getting at. I suppose I should say right up front, as has been true for the last couple of weeks, my talk today is rated PG-13. In this section that we're going to start looking at today, Paul seems to basically be damning marriage with faint praise. I mean, he manages to get to the level of saying, if you have to marry, I guess it's okay, you're not sinning. Which seems like a kind of a lukewarm endorsement of something that God created to begin with. So what's going on? I mean, what is Paul doing here? What is he trying to say to the Corinthians? And then what would that mean to us as we think about marriage, getting married, not getting married, being married? What is he trying to get at here is the question. I just want to say up front that this is a difficult section. I have been hammering on this section of 1 Corinthians for, you know, off and on for a long time. I think that I'm sort of getting someplace in understanding it, but I'm not going to go into all of the details of it, but there are just a number of places in this section where there are decisions that have to be made. And so I'm just telling you up front that I'm in the place where I have made a number of these decisions, and I think it makes sense. But there are a lot of those decisions to make here. Part of the problem is that we're moving into a section where Paul is addressing specific questions that he has been given through a letter that has come to them, to him. The Corinthians have written to him, and there are some issues that they're confronting. They're not quite sure what to do with. And it would be very helpful for us if we had their letter and knew what it was that they had been asking him, but we don't. So what we have to do is try to put it together based on what he answers. It's one of those deals where we're only hearing one side of the telephone conversation. You know, we're not hearing what the other person's saying, and we're sort of having to put it together. Well, so what question did they ask that led to a response like this? So let me read you the part that we're going to talk about today. At least we'll see which part we end up talking about, but let me start into it. In chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But on account of sexual immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband give what is owed to the wife, and likewise also the wife to the husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by mutual consent, for a time, in order that you might concentrate on prayer and might come together again, in order that Satan not tempt you on account of your lack of self-control. But I say this by way of concession, not of command. Now I wish that all men were also as I myself am, but each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I. But if they do not exercise self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn." Very famous statement. Okay. He starts out, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote." As I said, from here on in the letter, Paul is going to be addressing these issues that the Corinthians have raised. And this phrase, now concerning, keeps popping up. We're going to see now concerning things sacrificed to idols. And it seems pretty clear. They have asked him a question about that. Now concerning spiritual gifts, he's going to say, and it's clear that they had a question about that. So there are a series of questions that the Corinthians have asked Paul, and he's addressing them here. Things change in this section. From now on, it is not true that every one of the issues we're going to address is a big controversy in the sense that there's a group that's fighting Paul on these issues. Up to now, Paul has been quite aggressive in his language towards the Corinthians because there is a group among them who seem to be coming to the conclusion that he's not even really a legitimate apostle and they're not listening to him on some key questions. From here on, some of the issues are going to be like that and some of them not. I think here, this question is not motivated from a rejection of Paul's teaching. This is not some group that is saying, we don't have anything to do with Paul, we think his sexual ethic is outmoded or anything like that. That's not the sort of people who are raising this question, I don't think. The issue here is a genuine question that just has arisen in the church that people are looking to Paul. They're saying, so what would you say about this? In fact, I think there's probably a hint here that they think that they're following Paul in what it is that they're doing here. They're looking at the way Paul lives his life and they're saying, isn't this what you would think? Isn't this what you would support? That's quite likely that that's the situation. Okay, so what is this first issue then that they had a question about? The way Paul puts it, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, this statement has a long history in the church and I think has been seriously misunderstood in the history of the church. But you can understand the problem in dealing with it. What exactly is he getting at here? What is he saying? It is good for a man not to touch a woman. I hope by now that it is apparent to many of you that in these kinds of situations, especially, we know specifically, Paul is answering a specific question that the Corinthians have raised. It makes a lot of difference how you understand the issue to which he's responding. What kind of a statement is this? It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Think about it this way. Is Paul saying, No. I disagree with you Corinthians on this issue. I would say it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Is that the deal? Somehow they're all sex crazed in Corinth and he's saying, No, I've got to come along and correct you on that. You'd be much better off to just forget the whole thing. Is that where he's coming from? Or is he saying, yes, I wholeheartedly agree with you Corinthians. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. They have decided that we would all be better off if we just stayed away from sexuality altogether, and Paul's saying, you got it. That's right. I'm right with you on that. Well, I would like to vote for option number 3, which is neither of those. And what he's saying would be something like this. Well, yeah, I would agree that there's a sense in which you could say there's something good about a man not touching a woman. But I think you guys have misunderstood the point. That's what I think this whole chapter 7 is about. I would see the issue that Paul's addressing not being something like this, which is the way I used to think about it. When you first read it, you kind of get the impression maybe what he's saying is, look, I know you guys are really hot to get married, but I'm telling you it's much better if you just stay away from that whole thing altogether. I don't think that's the issue. That's not the question that they're asking him. What is happening, I think, here in the question that they're asking him is that there is a contingent in Corinth that is running with the idea that we are called to sexual purity in the direction of actually seeing sexuality as something to be avoided, as something negative and wrong. They look at the fact that Paul himself is celibate, he is not married, and they've heard the call to sexual purity, and they've decided that that must mean we should just stay away from this stuff altogether. Perhaps it's informed by some of that sort of thinking, as I've talked about before. We see in those places where the idea gets promoted that the body is evil, that somehow matter and the body, things having to do with the body, are evil, that there are these two directions you can go. Either you can go in the direction of licentiousness, so it doesn't matter what I do with my body, or you can go in that direction that says, therefore, I should totally stay away from anything having to do with bodily pleasures or anything like that altogether. Perhaps something like that is happening, that in the culture, we know that there's a group in Corinth that is licentious, that thinks it doesn't matter what you do sexually. Perhaps what we're finding here is a group that in the same philosophical climate is taking that in a different direction and deciding that basically we would be better off if we just stayed away from it altogether. I think what I see as being at stake in this issue, as one commentary puts it, Paul is celibate but not ascetic. An ascetic is someone who sees the bodily pleasures as something to be avoided, that it is more spiritual to abuse the body in the sense of, you know, I'm going to take my body and I'm going to inflict all kinds of deprivations on it instead of indulging it in any sense. I think what we find in this situation is Paul is not married, and he sees certain advantages to not being married, which he's going to talk about. But he is talking to Corinthians at this point who are truly ascetic. They think it is better to stay away from sexuality in particular. And so what we find in Paul's response here is a kind of balanced response that, no, you guys are missing the point. Yes, celibacy is a good thing. There are reasons not to get married. But marriage is also a good thing, and sexuality has its appropriate place in it. That's what I think Paul is getting at in this section. At least, that's how I see it right now. And this will be my last reminder. This is a difficult section to understand, but this is how I understand what he's doing right now. Okay, so he characterizes the issue. What the issue is going to be, that somehow he's responding to an idea that they have, which he could sort of support but sort of not, that it is good for a man not to touch a woman. That's going to be the theme that's going to run through the whole chapter. Is that true, and what sort of impact does that have on the decisions we make within marriage and outside of marriage? That's where he's going here. Now, he's going to bring up the first issue. There are a number of situations that he addresses. And what we see now is the first situation that he addresses. But this is not the only one. We're going to see a number of them as we go through the chapter. He basically sort of covers the bases. Well, what if you're in this situation? Well, what if you're in this situation? Here's the first one. But because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Now, we come right off the bat to the first big interpretive question in the section. Because it sure sounds like he's saying here in the beginning of this letter, celibacy is best. But I know that a lot of you guys can't control yourselves. If you're not married, you're just going to go off and do all kinds of horrible things. So I guess, given that situation, you'd better get married. That's the way that this is often, maybe you could even say traditionally, understood as to what Paul's saying. To not be married would be preferable, but you guys can't handle it. You guys will be off committing fornication right and left if you're not married, so you had better get married. Is that possible? Is that a possible way of understanding what he's saying here? Yes. But that is not what I understand him to be saying at this point. Now, there's this phrase, because of sexual immoralities. We're going to have to talk about that in a minute. That's one of the hardest phrases in this whole chapter. But I'm going to set that aside for a second. But let me take this statement, he says, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. What does that mean? Is that saying, let each man and woman get married? Let each man go and take to himself a wife and let each woman take to herself a husband? Is that what he's saying? It might sound like it. I mean, to our ears, it sounds like, well, okay, that could be. But for one thing, that's a sort of a strange thing for him to be saying here, for each man, each and every man to get married and each and every woman to get married, because he's actually going to go on and give advice that suggests, I think it'd be good if you don't get married in a lot of situations. So it seems kind of strange for him to be saying, I want everybody to get married, and then later on say, well, I don't. It's a little hard to put that together. But what's more relevant here is that this phrase, to have your wife, is a common expression in Greek for having sexual relations with your wife. It shows up often in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. This is the Greek translation of the Old Testament that Paul was very familiar with. He would have read the Septuagint, and his language in Greek is often influenced by what he has read in the Septuagint. When he picks a word to use in theological discussion, sometimes it's a language that he has picked up by reading the Septuagint. So, for instance, in Deuteronomy 28:30, in the Septuagint, basically it reads, "You shall take a wife, but another man shall have her." You see the implication there. You shall take a wife, that is, you're going to marry her, but another man is going to end up having her. And to have her in this idea is to have sexual relations with her. So you may be marrying her, but somebody else is going to be sleeping with her. That's basically what the language amounts to. And that language shows up, language like that shows up a number of places in the Septuagint. Now, does it have to mean that? No, I don't think it has to. In fact, later in the chapter, Paul is going to use the language of talking about those who have a wife, and I don't think that's what he means by it. So I have to be fair here. It's not that this phrase always means that, but it often does mean that. I think in this context, that way of understanding the language makes a whole lot more sense. So the first issue that he's addressing, I mean, it might not have occurred to us because it may not be a question that would have occurred to us. We don't live in a culture where this would have seemed to be like a good idea. But the first issue he's addressing here, I think, is not should you get married. The first issue he's addressing is if you are married, should you have sexual relations? Now, why would that be an issue? Why would anybody be thinking about that? Well, it would be because the idea would be that, gee, now that I'm following God and I'm on this spiritually enlightened path, I have decided, I think that sexuality actually is a bad thing. And it is true that I happen to get married, but now that I've seen the light, I recognize that that's something that you ought to stay away from. I am too spiritual to have anything to do with something like that. So what's happening in the situation is, in particular, in marriages in Corinth, one of the members of the marriage has decided that they are too spiritual to have sexual relations with their spouse, which has left the other person involuntarily celibate. All of a sudden now, I'm married to this person, but I'm living a celibate existence. And the person who has chosen to do this thinks that they are being spiritual, that they are serving God's purposes and accomplishing a higher good by doing this. That's what I understand the situation to be. That then makes a whole lot of sense out of the next two sentences, and indeed what Paul goes on to say in these next couple of verses, because then the sentence is basically parallel to the next two verses. So let me show you the parallel. Basically, he's saying, let each man have sexual relations with his wife, with his own wife, and let each woman have sexual relations with her own husband. Let the husband give what is owed to the wife, and likewise also the wife to the husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. The issue in all three statements is you married people need to be making yourselves available for a sexual relationship with your spouse. And the reason is that he has to say that is that that's the question that has been raised by them, that they think that somehow this idea, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, implies that they ought to just abstain altogether. Okay. So each of these three sentences, he's building, he's adding a little bit each time. He starts out by saying married people should continue to have sexual relations. Then he adds the husband and wife owe this to each other. And then he adds that the husband and wife do not have authority over their own bodies in this matter. Okay, now I have to talk about that idea a little bit, this owing and not having authority. Because that idea, while it is an important one understood in the right way, has been much abused also, I think, in the church, and we have to understand what's happening here. Remember that what I'm saying is that the issue in the context, the issue is, I know we're married, but I'm too spiritual to have sex with you. That's the situation. Okay, here in that situation, Paul is saying, I do not have the right to remove myself from my spouse in that way. In entering into marriage, I have made a commitment to the other person. I have joined my life with the other person, and sexuality is a part of that joining that marriage is. I have an obligation that I have entered into. I mean, just like I don't have the freedom to divorce and go marry somebody else, or I don't have the freedom to have an adulterous relationship with someone that I'm not married to, so I also don't have the right to decide that I'm not really married to you anymore. We're going to live together, but we're not going to be married. Because I have married this person. So I think when he talks about not having authority over my own body, he's saying that in entering into the marriage relationship, I have made a commitment that means that I don't have the freedom that I had before I was married. I have entered into a relationship that has put a certain obligation on me. I can't go back on the gift of myself that I have made to my spouse. But so that's the context, and that's, I think, the positive statement that he's trying to make here. But notice what he's not doing. And this is the way that we always end up perverting these kinds of statements. Paul is telling me to think this way. I myself have an obligation to my spouse. I myself do not have the right to decide that I'm going to renege on this promise, this gift of myself that I have made to my wife. He is not saying, I have the right to demand that my spouse give me whatever I want when I want it. The emphasis is on my obligation. I have to fulfill the commitment that I have made. He's not saying anything about how often or, you know, anytime anybody wants or anything like that. He's just saying, I don't have the right to decide I'm done with that. I'm not really going to be a married person with you anymore. We're just gonna be roommates and we'll be good friends. I can't do that because I married this person. That's a commitment that I made. But there's nothing in what he says that can be turned around and used as a weapon to demand of the other person that I get what I want when I want it. And frankly, this verse has been often abused, especially by men, I think, as kind of a, see, the Bible says you have to do it now. Which is not what Paul is getting at. That's not, well, I'll talk more about that in a minute. I want to say something more about that. Okay, but so the positive statement that he's making here is that neither person in a Christian marriage has the right to decide that they are above sexuality, because each has given of themselves to the other, and they have an obligation. They have a marriage that they must maintain. So he goes on to say, stop depriving one another, except by mutual consent, for a time, in order that you might concentrate on prayer and might come together again, in order that Satan not tempt you on account of your lack of self-control. Now, he says, stop depriving one another. And that really helps us to see the issue. It's this depriving one another that he's talking about. It's one of them deciding that I am going to withhold this. I'm going to make you go without. I'm done with this. So you don't get to participate in this anymore. That's what he's saying that he doesn't want them to do. It's this involuntary celibacy that he is saying you don't have a right to impose on someone that you made this promise to. But he says, he makes this exception, except perhaps by mutual consent for a time, in order that you might concentrate on prayer and might come together again. Now, I think if we see the situation, it really helps us to get this statement in perspective. Because I always, again, when you first read this, it sounds like what Paul's saying is that he really does recommend that you have regular periods of abstinence. That's not a word, is it? Abstinence? Did I just make that up? I don't know. Okay, well, I like it, though. It's a good word. If it wasn't there before, it needs to be there now. Where you need to forget about sexuality and go spend your time praying. Somehow your prayers are going to be interfered with. If you're having sexual relations with your spouse, you're not going to be able to pray as effectively as you could if you would stay away from that. So you really need to do that every now and again. But he doesn't say that. And in fact, if we understand the situation, I think we should look at it from the other side. He's talking to people who are saying, I am above sexuality. I have such a holy, pure relationship with God that I don't involve myself with that stuff anymore. What he's doing is saying, okay, I mean, if you happen to think that abstaining from sexuality is going to somehow, you know, help you to concentrate on your relationship with God more, fine. You can do that. You can have a period where you're not having sexual relations so that you can have more devotion to God. But there are three things that he says. First of all, there are these two conditions that need to be met. It must be by mutual consent. You both have to agree on this, that this is what you want to do. And secondly, it needs to be, what he says, for a time. And what he means is just a little bit, for a short time. You're not ending your physical relationship. You're agreeing together, we're going to have this short period of time where we're going to do this. But we're doing it with the specific idea that we are going to come back together again. I mean, that's the emphasis here. The third thing that he says, I think it's often misunderstood. He says, but I say this by way of concession, not of command. What he's saying is, I'm not telling you to go apart for a while to pray. I'm not saying to you that I think that your spiritual life will be enhanced and you'll be able to pray better if you're not having a physical relationship with your spouse. That's not my idea. I'm saying this by way of concession. If you think that there's a value in doing that, okay, fine. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. I'm not telling you that you need to enhance your spiritual life by abstaining from sexual relations with your spouse. But if you think there's some value in that, okay, fine. Go ahead. My concession is you can go ahead and do that if you think that's valuable. But my insistence is that you both agree about it and that it only be for a time. And why is he saying all of this? He's saying it because, again, he's talking to people who have gotten the idea that it would be better, more spiritual, to just stay away from it altogether. Okay, so that's what I think he's getting at. This section here is basically speaking to that kind of issue and giving his advice on how they ought to handle it, given the fact that there are people who have this perspective. Now, the hardest part of this section is what he starts with and what he ends with. He says, because of immoralities, because of fornications, because of sexual immoralities. Throughout this whole section, the last several weeks in 1 Corinthians, he has been talking about sexuality and sexual immorality, and it's this word that he uses, porneia. Sometimes translated fornication, sometimes translated immorality, and something like that is what we're talking about. Here it's plural, because of fornications, because of immoralities. And then at the end, he says, come back together lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control, which is another tricky word to get a hold of as to what's exactly happening there. The question is, there is this rationale that he seems to be appealing to, or this fact that he's appealing to. There are immoralities. There is this lack of self-control that seems to be a part of what he's referring to as to why they shouldn't take the course of parting from each other as man and wife, why they need to continue their sexual relationship. And what is that about? What is he getting at there? And this is a very hard question, I think. And it's one of the reasons why I'm saying to you that I'm tentative in the way I put this together, because it's difficult to know exactly what he means by this, but this is how I picture it right now. This is what makes sense to me right now. Imagine this situation. Remember, this is a particular situation and a particular group of people that Paul is writing to. They have asked him, presumably they have reported to him what's going on. You know, here's what's happening. We have this happening over here, we have this happening over here. And so he's responding to a situation of which he is aware. He knows what's been happening among the Corinthians. So here's the situation. You live in a sexually decadent culture where it is culturally acceptable for married men to regularly visit prostitutes. This is a place, a culture where marriage is seen to be important for the sake of raising legitimate children, but being faithful to your spouse, now this is not universally true. There are some parts of Greek and Roman culture that would have endorsed the idea of faithfulness, but many parts of it would not. So, even many of the men in your church regularly visit the prostitutes, and they think it's no big deal. I mean, we already know from the last section that there are those in Corinth who have a very licentious attitude towards sexuality. Okay? So here you are in the middle of this culture, and your wife has announced to you that she has decided that she is too spiritual for sex, and you can sleep on the couch for the rest of your life. Okay. What has been the result? Not just what theoretically might happen, but what in fact has been happening in Corinth. You have wives who are too holy for sex, and men who are instead are going off to visit the prostitutes and whatever. The actual result, what I'm thinking is, the actual result of this we are above sexuality has resulted in sexual immorality in various ways. Now, Paul, of course, would not justify that. He wouldn't say, see what you made him do. It's not like that. I mean, the language he uses is that Satan might not tempt you on account of your lack of self-control. The fact is that it is an evil that is being participated in. But The best I can understand at this point is that what Paul is saying is, look at the way this has been working out. This has not accomplished what you set out to accomplish here. The fact is that it is inappropriate for me to put my spouse in a situation where they are facing the pressures of celibacy in a non-celibate life. There's something inappropriate about that, and you're putting yourselves in a place where you're vulnerable to temptation. Now, would a righteous and godly person resist that temptation? Yes. But it is inappropriate for me to put my spouse in that situation. I think that's what Paul is getting at. I know some of you think that abstaining from sex is the more spiritual thing, but what you have actually accomplished in Corinth is the promotion of sexual immorality. Think about all the stuff that's going on around you. Doesn't this give you pause to think about, now wait a minute, how is this supposed to be working? Okay. So let me make some comments on the part that we have seen up till now. There's a lot more in chapter 7 to talk about, but just where we are, the first issue that he has raised, let me say something. First of all, I know that at first glance it seems like Paul has, like I said, kind of damning with faint praise attitude towards marriage and sexuality. But I think it's important for us to recognize that Paul is voicing a very positive view of sexuality here. As I understand it, for many men in the Greek and Roman world, sex with your wife was for raising legitimate children. Otherwise, there were prostitutes and mistresses and young men available for you to fulfill your sexual desires. You're not looking to your wife for fulfillment, you're looking to your wife for legitimate children. And then otherwise you go and do what you want. Many men lived that way. Paul is instead offering a picture of marriage which has a very positive place for sexuality within it. And it is not just for the raising of children. Obviously, children come into the world through sexuality. That's not unrelated to the purpose for which God made it. But that's not the only point. Because Paul doesn't say here, just make sure you get together enough time so that you can have a couple of kids, and otherwise do what you want. He talks about, in entering into marriage, that there is a commitment of my body that I am making to this other person. And he sees that as a good thing. Not just for the sake of bringing children into the world, but for each other's sake. There is something wrong about being married and being unwilling to share myself with my spouse in that way. Now, there's nothing wrong with being unmarried, but what would be bad is for me to enter into marriage and treat it as if it were not marriage. And an ongoing sexual relationship, Paul sees as a part of the commitment that we have made to each other in marriage. So in the cultural setting, this is a profoundly positive view of the role of sexuality in marriage. Another thing that's unique about what Paul's saying is the strong emphasis he has here on the mutuality of this relationship. The husband and the wife both have an obligation to each other. It is not that the wife has an obligation to the husband, which is the way that many, and I think many in this culture, would have portrayed it. It is that they, in marriage, have entered into a partnership where each has an obligation to the other. And that is very culturally distinctive, and I think an important thing for us to understand. There is a... Well, all of us recognize that there are differences between men and women in some ways. We have, the men have the reputation of being more aggressively interested in sexuality than women are. I'm no sociologist. I don't know what to tell you about all the ins and outs of that. It does seem to me that on the one hand, that is a at least an oversimplification of the situation. And on the other hand, even to the extent that it might be true, from Paul's perspective, it's so what? Sexuality in marriage is meant to be a mutual giving, something that each person is doing for the sake of the other. And so there really isn't any room in this picture for somehow that thing that has grown up, that traditional sort of model of the husband who just has one thing on his mind and the wife who tries to reluctantly be involved with it as little as she can. And the fact is, if I'm entering into a real marriage, I'm thinking about the other person and they're thinking about me. And in that way, that aspect of life is going to be worked out under a mutual consideration. That's what we have been called to, I think. Now, finally, I want to come back to this perversion of this idea that you don't have authority over your own body, which has led to that situation. I mean, again, there's sort of the stereotypical picture would be a Christian husband who uses this verse to demand of his wife what he wants whenever he wants it. Whenever the Bible calls someone to submission, that call is always addressed to the person who is being asked to submit. That is, the call is always to, there is something that it needs to be considered. The person that I should submit to has the responsibility for a certain area, and so I should recognize that and bow to the fact that they're accountable for what happens. Or, in this situation, I have made a commitment in marriage, and therefore I have a certain obligation to fulfill that commitment. It's always talking about what is my moral stance? What is the situation that I face as I decide what I'm going to do? There is already something deeply perverse about taking something that is supposed to tell me what my obligation is and turn it into a weapon to try to manipulate somebody else to do what I want them to do. The fact that Paul can speak of obligation here does not become some sort of support for spiritualized selfishness. It's okay for me to be selfish because Paul said you have an obligation. It never works that way. The fact is, it's kind of like, you know, what Paul says, as far as it depends on you, be at peace with all people. The issue is, how am I going to respond? What am I going to do? What this section is telling me is, I have an obligation to fulfill my commitment to be married and to think about the other person. That's what this tells me. So, this teaching has been perverted and turned into something really horrendous in some marriages. But that doesn't mean, that's not an indictment of what Paul's saying here. That doesn't say that Paul shouldn't have said it. He should have said it, because given the parameters in which he's speaking and the issue to which he's addressing, it's absolutely true. That obligation is there. But we have to understand it in the light of what it means to be loving and self-sacrificing in general. The fact that this obligation has been talked about here doesn't mean that there aren't many other obligations that we have to each other as well. And the fact is, in this context, given this issue, with people who are saying, oh, I'm above sexuality, I don't do that anymore with my spouse, they need to hear, the fact is you have an obligation that you need to fulfill. But that doesn't turn into any sort of... There's time for comments and questions, so I think I will.
Verse 5 where he says, Satan tempt you?
Yes.
First, I'm curious about the use of Satan instead of just, you know, your own drives and your own
right.
culture.
Right.
Secondly, why sex? Because in the temptation of Jesus, apparently Satan never tempted him with sex. Just food and power and that stuff.
Right. Well, okay. I don't have a great answer to your question. I have been thinking about that. Let me answer the second part of it first. The reason that sex is in view here is because that's the issue in the context. That is, what I'm doing in saying, I am above sexuality, you're out of luck, to my spouse, is I am putting them in this situation where they have been living a sexually active life with me, their spouse, and we're going to continue to live together, but I'm cutting it off. So that I think he's suggesting that you have created a unique and difficult sort of pressure on your spouse in that thing. It's one thing to be unmarried and celibate. It is another thing to be married and celibate. That's a situation for which we were not created. So the temptation that Satan is going to use in that situation is, this is a person who has been cut off from a sexually active life, still living with the person with whom they have been having a sexual relationship, and yet we're just going to forget it. The temptation then is to, all right, well, you can't cut me off like that. If you're not going to fulfill your obligation, then I'm going to find some way of taking care of this. I think that's the kind of thing that he's getting at. I think Paul sees what's striking in this, it's Satan tempting, but it's on account of your lack of self-control, or it's a little bit hard to get a hold of this word, your akrasia. He's not saying, there's no hint, I think, in Paul's thinking that it's, you know, the devil made me do it. It's my lack of self-control that's going to ultimately lead me into this. But it is true that I think Paul sees Satan in this world as trying to trip us up, as trying to take advantage of situations to lead us into evil. There's no justification. What I think we can't do, what's hard in putting this together, is we can't see this as somehow Paul saying to the one spouse, like I said, look what you made him do, or look what you made her do. Because that's not true. And we always have a choice as to how we respond to things. And if that's the way it is, then that's the way it is. I'm still called upon to act righteously. But I think Paul is suggesting what he's trying to undercut is this idea, look at the great spiritual thing I have brought about by doing this. We're all done with that icky sex stuff. That's bad. The body and all of that. We're onto the higher plane. And he's saying, no. The fact is that you're still people who have bodies. And you're just messing with your minds. I mean, this is not, you're not going to accomplish holiness through this. You're just going to make it more difficult to be actually moral in the way that you conduct yourself sexually. Because you have cut off the gift that God has given you that involves your sexuality and left the only way pursue a sexual relationship anymore is going to be immoral. That's a foolish thing to do. When in fact you have made a commitment to be there for the other person, to be the partner in life with this person that you promised to be. So, I don't know, that's the best I can do with that, I think.
Would it be possible to translate the "it is good for a man not to touch a woman"? Would it be possible to translate that "it is okay for a man not to touch a woman"?
Yes, I think so. Although, see, we haven't seen the rest of what Paul has to say. I think that their statement is coming out of something that they recognize in Paul, is that he does see a certain value in celibacy. Now, we're going to have to talk about that. What is that value, and how do we put that together with the value of marriage and that kind of stuff? But I think what they're responding to is not just, I think it is okay for a man not to touch a woman doesn't set up everything that Paul is going to deal with in this chapter. I think it's a little stronger statement than that. But the way it gets mitigated is not by taking good and making it okay. It gets mitigated by saying, yes, there is a good there, but it's only a certain kind of good, and you have misunderstood what kind of good it is.
So he's not saying it is permitted for a man not to touch a woman. He's actually saying, given the right circumstances, it can be a positive thing for a man not to touch a woman.
We need to
talk about those circumstances.
Right. And see, the reason he's saying that is because that's what they're saying. I mean, he's basically saying, okay, yeah, fine, but let's talk about what this actually translates into. So we have a man, Paul, who believes in the value of celibacy to a certain extent, dealing with a group who has jumped past that. Some of them have jumped past the idea that there's some value in celibacy to the idea that there is something spiritual about asceticism, about actually abstaining from any bodily pleasures or anything like that. And so what Paul wants to do is say, throughout this section, no, I see a value in celibacy. There's a sense in which I would say, I wish that you could join me in not being married. And we have to talk about that's the next thing he's going to talk about. But you guys have got it all wrong. You have misplaced the issue. You don't understand what's at stake or what that good would be or what the implications of that would be for how you should conduct yourself. And the first place you have missed it is those of you who have decided to withhold sexual relations from your spouse. You have misunderstood the good that is involved in abstaining from sexual relations. That is not a good there. That's a bad.
Hi there. I'm not sure about this question. I was going to ask it in private, but I think a lot of people might have this question as well. So I'm wondering, the verse that she just asked about, let's see here, good for a man not to touch a woman. For those of us who are single and wonder about sharing affection during dating, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah.
Some boundaries, or will you be getting into that eventually?
Well, I don't think that language tells us anything about those boundaries. We would have to look elsewhere, mm-hmm. because I understand it to be just a euphemism for sexual relationships. Mm-hmm. For when he says it's good for a man not to touch a woman, what he means, he doesn't mean it's good for me not to touch her. He means it is good for me not. It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman,
unless you're married. And
right,
understand that. But there's because we're humans and we can rationalize any behavior. It's like, okay, well, if we're not married, then does that mean we don't hold hands or we never hug or something like that?
So right,
kind of taking it in that direction as
right.
well.
Right. Well, I can speak to that if you want. What I'm saying is what Paul has said here doesn't help us decide. That is, he isn't saying literally anything about touch, so we would have to decide on the grounds of putting together a whole picture of sexual ethics in the Bible. What is sexuality, and when have I crossed a line with someone else? My answer would be that physical intimacy with someone else. I'm drawing largely on what Jack has said about, which I really makes a lot of sense to me, about sexuality being a natural language. That physical intimacy with someone else is a way of saying something to them. And when I am intimate with someone, when I am sharing a part of myself that I don't share with other people, there is this thing that I am saying. I am giving myself to you. I am making myself available for you exclusively. And I think that it is inappropriate for us to make that statement to anyone that we in fact have not made that commitment to. In other words, I have no business being intimate in the way that communicates I am for you and you are for me, when in fact that's not true. In other words, we're not married. When we're married, that's true. If we're not married, it's not true. So, hugging, people hug in all kinds of situations. I mean, I know a number of women who have hugged me in various situations. Do I feel uncomfortable about that? No. Because I don't think in that situation we are being physically intimate in the sense that the Bible would talk about. I mean, there is no... what is being communicated in that hug is true. We are friends. I'm glad to see you. That's it. Could a man and woman who are both single hug each other and communicate that? Yeah, I think they could. Is there a real strong possibility in the right circumstances that that could turn into actual sexual intimacy of some sort that would be communicating the wrong thing? Yeah, I think it could. So there's no right or, you know, you can't have that like the 12-inch rule or that kind of stuff. It doesn't work that way, I don't think. I mean, it's just... what you have to decide is, am I going to be honest and faithful to God in the way I conduct myself with other people? Am I going to make sure that I am not communicating an intimacy with someone that is inappropriate? So my personal perspective is, I think our culture, in the whole dating culture right now, we have ended up promoting the idea that what I'm looking for is somebody that I can hang around with for a while and be as intimate as possible. The boyfriend-girlfriend sort of stuff is, this is semi-marriage. I get to be intimate with this person in a way that I'm not with someone else. And I think we as Christians need to strongly look out for that. It is a lie. I'm setting that other person up for a fall. That when I decide this is as far as I want to go with this, I have with my body been making a commitment to them that I am then tearing off, and I'm inflicting pain that I should never have inflicted because I was lying. I think that's inappropriate. But in and of itself, I think I still remember the very first Christian conference that I ever went to on sexuality and that stuff at Peninsula Bible Church. This was in 1972, and I had just become a Christian. As a matter of fact, it was the first place that I encountered Jack, because Jack was a speaker at that conference. But this was a long time ago. We were both a lot younger then. But I remember one speaker at that, someone asked him about, so is it okay to say to a, you know, this is a guy talking, is it okay to say to a woman, I love you as a brother in Christ? And he said, well, it probably is, but I think I would avoid saying I love you as a brother in Christ while you're sitting out under the moonlight. It's kind of that sort of thing. I mean, it all depends on the context. What are we communicating here as we do this? Okay, well, I guess we're kind of out of time, so we'll pick this up next time.